Welcome to episode 305 of the Tennis Files podcast, a Q&A session with a 17-time Grand Slam champion with Gigi Fernandez.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey there, I hope you're all doing well and playing a lot of tennis and improving your game. For today's episode, I am bringing you a really fun Q&A session that I had with legendary 17-time Grand Slam champion Gigi Fernandez that we did a little while back. And she answered audience questions on strategy, the mental game, injuries, meditation, visualization, technique, and more. So definitely a really valuable session that I think you'll really enjoy. It's always amazing to get advice from people who have performed at the most elite levels of the sport. And then Gigi is also doing a ton of coaching right now as well. So I definitely think you'll get a lot out of this one. And so without further ado, here's my discussion with 17-time Grand Slam champ, Gigi Fernandez.
So good to see you again, Gigi. How are you?
Great to be here. Took a while, literally. Sorry about the little delay. We had technical issues.
Oh, yeah, no worries. It always happens, so it's no biggie. But yeah, so nice to see you. And yeah, I just want to reiterate how much fun I had seeing you a couple weeks ago at TennisCon Live in Tampa, beautiful Innisbrook Resort. It was so cool. So
super fun, yeah.
Yeah, like great job to you and Leslie and all the coaches. Yeah, and the group was just amazing. And I see a lot of them actually in the live streams, and they emailed me and stuff for the summit. So it's really cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Happy to hear definitely. That.
Thanks a lot. Let's see. We got some comments in. Gordon, hi, Gigi.
Hey, Gordon.
So Gordon had a little rough patch here. He said, I played a final a week ago and was one set all, then my calf popped. Ouch. Bizarrely, I hit the zone and won the next 24 points. The ball seemed slow and big. What can I learn from hitting?
Wait, with the calf popped?
How does that work?
I don't
know
how your calf pops and you don't go straight to the ER.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's so, I've had like a calf straight. Go ahead. Yeah.
So it wasn't a pop. It was just like strained. Okay. So what is the question? What is the best thing?
What can I learn from hitting the zone? Just get in as much as possible.
Well, yeah. I mean, the key is how to get in the zone, right? And it seems like this elusive thing that all players try to get into, like the zone, right? But there, if you have done any work on the mental game, or anybody who has done work on the mental game knows that there's really some defined steps that you have to take to give yourself the best opportunity to get in the zone. You might or might not get in the zone, but if you don't take these steps, there's no way you're ever going to get in it. You know, and some of these things include your pre-match preparation. It's very important. Like what are you doing before your matches? What are you doing the night before, the morning of? How are you preparing yourself mentally for the battle? Also your routines and your rituals, what kinds of things are you doing on a consistent basis between the points? Your self-talk is important to getting you in the zone. So, you know, obviously your game, you know, from the physical perspective, your game has to be at a certain level for you to be able to flow freely and not have to think so much about the technical part of your game. I always tell players, once they're in match mode, you know, competing, keeping score in a match that counts, that they should not be thinking about technique, that they should not be worrying about the swing path or if they're hitting the ball early or late, and just kind of worry more about how to win the point. And your thoughts really should revolve around what you have to do to try to win points, and not so much why your ball went, you know, 6 inches long.
Yeah, and I think some people might have the perception that being in the zone is just like a state where you like you're not even like thinking at all. But I mean, is that true? I mean, because you mentioned like, you know, that self-talk is important. So I guess is that right that you are still doing the self-talk? You're still talking about or telling yourself, you know, what I need to do on each point and stuff.
I mean, anybody who's ever tried to meditate or just quiet your mind knows how impossible it is to not have thoughts. Like our brain is not designed to not think unless you're sleeping, right? And and then if you're sleeping, then you're not aware. But the key is controlling the thoughts that you have while you're playing and not letting that sort of voice in your head bring you down, because we are inherently programmed to fail, right? Our mind wants to bring to shoot us down and make us fail. So unless you have some techniques and tactics to not let it, it will. So I always had this sort of dual personality in my brain where I was always fighting. Gigi was always fighting Beatrice, right? And it was always like, who's going to win? Good Gigi or bad Beatrice, right? So, you know, whatever name you give your two voices, but everybody has two voices. And the key is to not let the bad voice win.
Yeah, I'm going to give my alter ego the name Peter Freeman. Let's see. He was giving me some stick during Ryan's live stream anyway, but now he's, we love him. Let's see. So we have, I forgot if I read these out. Yeah. Jennifer, hi from Puerto Rico. Yeah. Great to see you again. Sherry, hello from Mississauga. I don't know if I pronounce that right. Good to see you. Angel, prepping dinner early. Dinner. Wow. Where are you at? I have my Topspin probe out back. Thanks, Ryan. Cool. Nice. Gordon, thanks. Haven't played since physiotherapist orders. It was a weird and freaky out of body experience. Went back 25 years. Interesting though. Wow. Very, very interesting. And yes, the calf popped. Oh wow. The zone is astonishing. Yeah, that's crazy. Done lots of work on mental game as a Gigi devotee. That's smart. Devoting yourself to the right things here. Bill, hey, Maribon and Gigi, back home in North Carolina, finally. Awesome.
Do we have questions?
Let's see.
Pete. I'm sure Pete can come up with a question or Maribon.
Yeah, an actual question, Pete, not just trolling me. Don't think of technique or score and play things back there. So we don't have any quite yet, but I think people are streaming in. I see their numbers keep rising. So Gigi, I guess in terms of the mental game again, what's one of the biggest changes or adjustments you had to make from maybe before you were on the tour to like then like a few years after? Maybe there's something big that you learned, like mentally speaking, that like helped you a lot when you changed that.
Well, I mean, I think what I can talk about, not so much after, but really what I did that cost the change in my career to, you know, where I was, I've been playing for 5 years and not won a Grand Slam and then won one or two, and 7 years into my career, won one or two. And then I also won 14 and pretty much in a row. I mean, in 5 years, I won 14 Grand Slams. So it was almost three per year. And what I did was two things that were critical. The first one was I learned to meditate and I learned diaphragmatic breathing. So I learned how to breathe from the diaphragm, and that breathing really, really deep, which I know, Maribon, you're an expert at, really relaxes you and increases blow flow in, to your muscles. So you get less tired, less lactic acid buildup, lowers your heart rate, lowers your blood pressure. And anybody can practice diaphragmatic breathing. If you Google diaphragmatic breathing, you can read all kinds of people talking about how to actually use your diaphragm, which is the bottom of your lungs. Right now, when we're breathing, we're using a third of our lungs, shallow breathing. But when you play a match, you have to do these really, really deep breaths, or not necessarily when you're playing the match, but on the changeovers and before matches, and all to try to get you to, or you, myself, or the person doing it, to stay calm. Because what's really hard in tennis, it's a fine motor sport, right? So it's little changes in your muscles and the tightness of your hand or your tightness of your shoulder will affect the direction of the ball. So you're really trying to stay relaxed and try to, you know, stay calm. And that's where the breathing came in. And then the second part was which was even more powerful, was the learning how to meditate. Because when you meditate, you sit in a quiet space for 20 minutes and you repeat a mantra, or you can just repeat your breath going in and out. So you, your thoughts would be, you know, as you're breathing in, breathe in, breathe out, and you just keep repeating that if you don't have a mantra. But what you'll find is that pretty much 20 seconds into it, your mind has gone off and it's now thinking about the grocery list and the got to pick up the kids and I have a lesson tomorrow and, you know, all the things that's on our to-do list that are constantly in our brains that we can't get our minds off. And, you know, at first I would get really mad at myself because I couldn't focus for 20 minutes. And it was like, okay, how can I not focus for 20? How am I going to play a 2-hour match if I can't focus for 20 minutes? And I would get really pissed off. And, you know, slowly but surely, I started to learn how to bring my mind back to the mantra and could sustain the mantra a little bit longer. I could go minutes at a time, maybe. And also, if you get really technical, like the gurus or person who taught me this, they claim that the space between repeating the mantra, so that little nanosecond between repeating one mantra and starting the next, is where your mind is quiet and your mind is at ease and your mind is at peace. So you reach this level of, I don't know what you call it, like nirvana, I guess, nirvana. Or whatever. And it sounds very esoteric, but in reality, what it did for me was that it taught me how to change one thought for another without judgment or emotion. So I learned how to remove emotions from my thoughts. And that's a very important skill in, you know, in life, but particularly in sports, because the biggest detractor of peak performance are your thoughts and what you tell yourself. Yeah. So if I could, you know, and for me, I was very passionate and I had combustible temper, you know, I could just really explode. Really? And yeah, I did.
I know.
I know, you know, and a lot of people don't know that. Really follow my career, you wouldn't know that. So to learn how to control those thoughts and you know, change that anger thought for another one was really powerful. And I fully claim meditation to have, you know, been the biggest influence in my career, because I went from learning to meditate and practicing diaphragmatic breathing, which was April of 1992. And I won the French Open in May, Wimbledon in July, the Olympic gold medal in August, US Open in September, the Championships in November, and the Australian Open in January, and probably three other regular tour tournaments, and all within a 6 period of learning how to meditate. So yeah, if you're not, you know, if you're a hyper player, or if you have busy mind, or if you have, you tend to get overly excitable, or you type A personality, this would be very valuable for you. Interestingly enough, this meaning learning to meditate would be very valuable for you. But interestingly enough, Martina, when I went to learn to meditate, I was with Martina and Billie Jean King. They actually invited me to the Deepak Chopra Center. And I asked Martina did one of my camps. I do camps with other legends. And when I shared this with her, with the group, not this whole long story, but I shared part of it with her. And she said for her, it didn't work, because when she got too calm and she got too mellow, so she felt like she needed to get mad and she needed to get angry. So she plays better angry. So interesting, like it's not clear, obviously not for everybody, but for me, it really worked.
Yeah, it's definitely incredible how much that can help you refocus. And yeah, I mean, meditating, you know, especially as part of a daily routine in the morning or whenever, is really helpful. Right. Just for all facets. It's amazing. So yeah, the questions are streaming in now. So that's great. Let's see. Philip, as a high school coach, how do I get my player to get past the negative mindset when he steps up in competition?
So, you know, generally speaking, athletes are very competitive. Obviously, we're all competitive. So the way I framed that was I was in competition with the other me, right? So I don't know what your athlete's name is, but come up with an ulterior name or some name. You know, Beatrice is my given name, which I don't like. Gigi was the, you know, the badass Grand Slam champion. And so I was always battling Gigi and Beatrice. And who I wanted to win, obviously, I want Gigi to win. We all want to do well. It's just that we have this other person bringing us down. So I always felt like I never wanted to lose twice. I didn't want to lose the match and lose the mental battle against my opponent that was in my head. So if you could at least win the mental battle with the opponent in your head, you have a, and you lose the match, you're going to feel better about yourself But chances are that you're going to give yourself a better chance of winning if you can try to beat the. So you also turn the focus away from winning the match for your athlete. Instead of the focus being on winning the match, it's like, okay, for the next match, I don't care if you win or lose, but I want you to beat your mind. I want you to come off the court and say, okay, I beat my mind. My mind didn't beat me today. And if that happens, then over time, you'll start winning matches.
Awesome. Love that advice. So good. Let's see. What do we have next? Bruce, have you met Ricky Martin from Puerto Rico?
I'm trying to think if I met. I probably have, but it. Oh, I did. I'm sorry. Yes, I did. I went to his concert in Orlando. I don't know how many years ago, 15 years ago. And I went backstage and took a picture with him and met his kids. Yeah, it was super fun. Big fan.
Yeah, yeah. It's great music. Very lively. Oh, Pete again, my alter ego. Tell the don't worry, be happy story.
I really? Okay. So, okay. So, 1988 US Open, I've been playing tennis for 4 years and I was going to quit. I was unhappy. I was losing, obviously, you know, the thing is like I had a fairly successful junior career, meaning I was number one in the country or in Puerto Rico in my age group, two above. I didn't lose very much. I was lucky that I got a scholarship to play at Clemson University. I played my first freshman year in college. I lost two matches all year. And then I went to NCAAs and I made the finals. Lost in the third set tiebreaker, 7-6 in the third. And then I turned pro. And what happens when you turn pro? You lose every single week. Singles loss, doubles loss. Lose, 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 lose. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't used to losing. I didn't know how to lose. I didn't understand that losing were learning experiences. So I got to the 88 US Open and that was going to be my last Grand Slam. I told my agent, I think I've run my course. It's 5 years. I miss my family. I want to be a doctor. So I'm going to move on and do something else. So he says, okay, before you do that, why don't you go meet Dr. Jim Lehrer? So I met Dr. Lehrer and I spent 2 or 3 weeks or four, I don't know how long, working with him the summer leading up to the US Open. So he said, we did two things. The first one was he taught me what to do with the 25 seconds between points. And that's obviously very important, what your thoughts are between points, because 84% of the time we're not playing a point. So that's when we're in our head. And then the second thing he said was, do you know how to act? And I said, well, I don't know. What do you want me to do? And oddly enough, my great uncle was Jose Ferrer, who won an Academy Award in the 1950s for best supporting actors in a movie. So maybe I had the acting gene and I didn't know it. And he said, okay, I want you to act like you're having fun. I know you hate tennis. And I know at the end of this Grand Slam, you're going to retire. And that's fine. I support it. But let's just fool the crowd. Let's fool everybody that's watching you. And I want them to look at you and see, wow, that girl's really having fun. I said, okay, I'll try it. So I go play the first match. I win that 6-4 in the third. And I come off the court and he says, did you have any fun? And I said, no, I didn't. It was 6-4 in the third is stressful. So he said, okay, try it in the next match. So I tried in the next match, won that. Tried in the next match, won that. Tried in the next match, won that. And now we're playing in the semifinals of the US Open against the best team in the history of tennis, who is Martina Navratilova and Pam Shriver with 21 Grand Slams. So more Grand Slams as a team than any other male or female combination. So we really had no chance. But the song of the time was Don't Worry, Be Happy. And that's sort of why Pete said that. So we kept singing this song throughout the tournament and before the matches and during, you know, the changeovers. We were just thinking, don't worry, be happy. And I kept pretending like I was having fun. And we won. We beat them 6-3 in the third. And I come off the court and Jim says, are you having fun now? And I'm like, you guess I'm having fun. I'm in the finals of the US Open. So I won the US Open. We won that, my first Grand Slam, tricking my mind into thinking that I was actually having fun. So that was really the first time that I thought, wow, if I could just figure this out, I could have a career. So it was really life-changing. Yeah.
That's incredible. I was on the precipice of quitting and look what you did. Sick.
You know, it's funny, like in my life, I don't know if you've had this experience, Mirvan, or not, or people listening, but I've always found that in my life, whenever I was in the cusp, when I was like in my worst moments, like something awful seemed to should be happening, great things would come after. Like, this is one example of that. Like, I was going to quit. It was my lowest point ever. And then I won a Grand Slam. The other example in my career was the 94 Wimbledon. I got to the 94 Wimbledon and I had lost 9 straight first round singles matches. So I hadn't won a match all year. And I got to, I was number 99 in the world and I was the last person to get in the main draw. And I made it to the semis of the singles. my best Grand Slam result ever. So if you're going through a rough patch or, you know, not in a great space right now, something good is on the other side, and you just got to hang in there and keep plugging away. You know, life is long and has all ups and downs, and the only thing we can't overcome is death. So until that point, you just keep going and things turn around, and whatever you're going through passes. This too shall pass is one of my favorite lines, and we just continue on.
Yeah, that's such a great story. I mean, I could share one too. It actually has to do with the summit. Like in 2019, like I went through like a breakup, like during prep for the summit, like, and it was like a 6-year relationship. So, and it was actually like, I feel like being so busy for the summit and other stuff, but maybe it was a cause of it. So then I was like, I almost didn't do it that year. I was like, forget it, like whatever. But then I said, no, you know, like people are expecting it. So I did it, and like it did pretty well. And then like the next year, like it exploded and like the numbers all went up and stuff like that. So that was a tough time, but you know, just got to push through. So So you'll have to remember these things like when you're in tough times. So yeah, that's awesome. Let's see, Sherry, I had that experience with an injury too. It happened and I blacked out for a tiny short while. That's crazy. Glad you're still with us. David, I had one time when I was in the zone and then went out. The problem time then was it took me too long to realize I was out and lost too many points before I realized it. Huh, interesting.
So let me make a point about medical timeouts, because I just had this experience. Medical timeouts are allowed on any competitive match. You can always take, pretty sure, league USDA matches, you can always take a medical timeout. I was just playing and that other sport that some tennis players are now playing on Monday at the US Open in Naples. Which sport might that be, right? And in the semifinals, I cramped. I started to cramp. And I have this product called Cramps Away, which is a little packet you take. And stops the cramp, right? But instead of taking the medical timeout, I just took the cramps away and I kept playing. And I was concerned because I kept feeling like I'm going to cramp. And so I wasn't moving. I was focusing on not cramping as opposed to playing. So really, I should have taken the medical timeout. I should have taken, you know, 5-10 minutes to let the product absorb, drink some water, get sort of rehydrated, you know, and go back. So we ended up losing the match, but then came around and won bronze. So I could play 2 more matches after starting to cramp, which normally once you cramp, you're done. So the advice is, if you ever feel like you're starting to cramp, just take the medical timeout. Don't play through it, because you can rehydrate, take pills, take Cramps Away or whatever product you're using, to help you. Don't fight through it.
Yeah.
Don't be stubborn like I was.
Well, you know, it helped you in a lot of ways. In some ways, you know, you learned from it, but, that's so funny. You mentioned Cramps Away. I had James Blake on the summit a few years ago, and it was part of like a, you know, Cramps Away brand as well. We had the CEO, I think, there. Yeah, so that was, it's a cool product.
It's funny because I never cramped when I was playing. I never had cramping issues, but I think when you age, it's more prominent. Your body composition changes and you're more likely to prone as you age. So just another great thing about getting old.
Yeah, well, got to find different ways. You get wiser, though. So that's
true.
Steve, hello, Mirabon GG. Hello to you, Steve. Angel, so your teammate is really struggling with their shot selections during a match, i.e. low percentage shots, outside of cheering them on, I think. What suggestions do you have to reel that person in?
Yeah, so, you know, really shows shot selection in tennis. So the question is, are they missing? From what I'm reading, they're missing because they're trying low percentage shots. So really, you shouldn't be trying low percentage shots. So that's the problem. It's like having a conversation with him beforehand. It's like, why are you trying these shots? Like, I didn't try low percentage shots. I didn't win 17 Grand Slams by trying low percentage shots. I can promise you that. Like, you know, anytime a tennis player hits the ball, they have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 choices, depending on your skill level. I had probably 6 or 7 choices every time the ball came. and the true discipline or the true edge that players have is making the right choice. It's not executing the shot. You know, we're going to execute the shots. Everybody's going to make shots and miss shots, but it's really the choice of the shot you're trying to make that's going to win you the matches. So it's probably, you know, having a conversation with them about, first of all, do they understand what is low percentage? A lot of people don't have a clue that the shot they try to is low percentage. Like I just laugh when I do my cams because I'll see a person trying a shot and I'm like, did you just try to hit a high drop volley angle in front, like down the line from above your shoulders, standing on the service line? They're like, yeah. I'm like, I wouldn't try that shot. A down the line drop shot angle from a volley above your waist, like low percentage. You're going to make it 1 out of 1,000 times. I'll make it 1 out of 10, which is too low for me anyway. So really first understanding what is high percentage, and really in doubles, the ball should be crossing the middle window, which is if you divide the net into thirds, the ball should be going through the middle third 98% of the time. 98% of the time, the ball should be going through the middle third of the net when you're playing doubles. So tell them to stop. Just draw a window there. Say, go from here to here, put the ball through there, and your doubles game is going to improve right away.
Yeah, definitely, Gigi. And I guess, you know, when you were communicating with your partners, and you know, I'm sure at some point maybe they were having making these mistakes, like, I guess, were you like, did you say it to them straightforwardly, like, hey, like, you should stop doing this? Because I guess because I was wondering, the communication.
So first of all, you can never tell somebody to stop doing something, right? Because if you say don't do a fall, you're going to do a fall. Yeah, if you say don't hit it down the line, they're going to hit down the line. And you always want to communicate in plural, right? So it's always like, I would always say, we need to do this. So I would say on the next shot, okay, on the next two shots, okay, in the next 2 points that we play, let's hit every ball through the middle, both of us. So, and I always did it in twos because then it took pressure off. So if I say to my partner, we got to win the next point, that's pressure. But if I say to my partner, let's win 1 out of the next 2 points, all right, then either you win your point or I have to win my point. Now I've divided the pressure between the two of us. I didn't put pressure on her to win the next point. And that was how I always communicate. And I played the ad side, right? So it was always, okay, it's deuce. Let's win 1 out of the next 2 points. If you win your, if I say win your points, so I can get a break point, that's pressure. But if we win 1 out of the next 2 points, it's still deuce, right? You win yours, I win mine. It's deuce. You win your, right? You win. Now, but if she wins hers, then now I got a chance to break. Yeah. But if I say to her, let's win this point, that's pressure, right? So always communicate in plural and always give commands that are in a positive frame. Never don't do anything. It's always do this instead.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, I have a friend, Kendra, I'll shout her out, but she was telling me how she had an issue with a partner, you know, kind of going for low percentage shots. So definitely we're going to tell her this advice if she's not on the stream anyway. Let's see. Alfred, hi. I've got arthritis in my right middle finger of all things. Can't grip the racket properly. What do you, any thoughts on that?
My right
middle finger.
You know, it's funny because really when you pull up, I'm gonna get my racket. When you play tennis, you really grip with these two fingers and these two fingers, right? So this finger really is not doing much. Like if you hold the racket with the knuckle part and the thumb part and then put the hand around it, like I could play tennis with my finger straight up. That finger is not doing anything. Like these fingers are doing a lot. They're gripping, they're adjusting the grip, but that index finger. So, I mean, not to minimize your injury, but if of all the fingers that you don't use in tennis, that would be the one to not be so concerned about. So try to squeeze more with the other fingers.
Yeah. Yeah. No, great advice. Awesome. Let's see, Sherry, meditation is not that hard, although it is tough to refocus sometimes, but plus it can help you focus on everything around you without needing to restrict your focus onto just one element, even helps you gain precognition abilities. Yeah.
But it's hard though. I mean,
yeah,
you're probably a master guru, Sherry. You're
I know, like right?
Zen master, right? But it is hard to focus on one thing for 20 minutes. At least it is for me, or it was for me at first. And even it's funny now because you know, sometimes I'm, when I'm going through really stressful periods, I'll remember, okay, I need to meditate. And I was on a plane, once, and it was appeared like it was, there was a lot of turbulence and I was really nervous about it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to meditate. So I started to meditate and I set my timer for 20 minutes. You're supposed to set a timer.
Yeah.
I set my timer for 20 minutes and I started to meditate. And then all of a sudden, you know, I started to read, watch a movie, eat, look at my computer, and the timer went off. I'm like, oh my God, I was supposed to be meditating.
Oh, what a session.
So, yeah, right? So it's like, yeah. But then that was the first time I'd done it in years. You know, once you get in the groove of it, it's a little bit easier to...
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I agree. It can be very... I guess from the standpoint of, like, you know, you just, like, sit somewhere or cross your leg, whatever. Like, it's easy to initiate, at least.
Make
like
yourself do it, yes.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
to actually do it well is what can sometimes be a little challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it's very cool. I mean, now they have all these apps, like Headspace. I use that, and Calm as well. I've used that. Those are nice, and there's many others. Let's see. Macy, is there a good exercise that duplicates playing tennis, so if you can't play, at least you can keep your level of fitness high?
What types of stuff did you do? It's funny. I was going to go to visualization, but then the last bit of the question threw me, because keep your fitness high, but it would keep your tennis sharp. If you can visualize playing tennis, you just watch yourself hit shots with your eyes closed. And, you know, the mind doesn't know the difference between perception and reality. Like, you can close your eyes and think you're in center court Wimbledon if you've actually been there, and you can be a center court Wimbledon, and your brain thinks the same, it feels the same, it acts the same, right? You can trick your brain into pretending like you're there. So you can practice forehands and practice backhands in your mind. But to keep fit, I like pickleball. You know, tennis is very anaerobic. You can't go for a run, doesn't help you. You can do the Peloton as long as you're doing like interval work, where your heart's going up and your heart's going down. If you're gonna go for a jog, like run 30 yards or 50 yards, walk 20 seconds, run 30 yards, walk 20 seconds, run 30 yards more. So you sort of replicate the match rhythm, which is a burst and then you have a 20 second break, a burst and you have a 20 second break. But really the best way is to play tennis. So that's my advice. The Stairmaster, if they still have Stairmasters, I don't know. That's what I used to do. I love the Stairmaster because it was non-impact. But pickleball, I mean, pickleball is the sport that most closely resembles. excuse me, I have to mute myself.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, I have a good idea of what. Well, I'll jump in right now as well.
Go for it.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So I don't want to ruin, you know, Dr. Mark Kovacs' presentation, but you definitely want to check it out on Saturday. We also did a live stream with him actually on Monday night. But he talks about the biggest misconceptions around tennis fitness for adult players. And he specifically covers tennis specific endurance. So, I mean, he basically does say that, you know, tennis is the best, playing tennis is the best way to like train for tennis. But besides that, you want to do intervals, because if you think about it, you know, you rest, the rest to playing ratio is somewhere around like 4-1 or 3-1. So you want to kind of replicate that, because if you look at a tennis match, you have like, you know, your heart rate goes very high and then it goes significantly lower and then it'll go high again and low. So, I mean, interval training, as Gigi said, is going to be your best bet in terms of like training if you're not doing tennis or, you know, pickleball, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one thing to add to that, if you want to test it to see how you're actually doing, time, how long it takes for a heart rate to get back down. So depending on your age, this is hard to measure for everybody, but like, say that your max heart rate is 150 and you're like out of, you know, can't play. And when your heart rate's 100, you're okay. You can play. Then measure how long it takes for your heart to get from 150 to 100. And it should be taking 20 seconds. If it's taking longer than that, you know, you're going to start a point with your heart rate up. You're going to be in trouble, right? So that's the, you know, the true measure of fitness for a tennis player is, first of all, how long can you go? Can you go 3 hours? But how quickly is your heart rate dropping so that when you start the next point, you're not starting from an elevated heart rate?
Yeah, yeah, great points there. Let's see, you got a lot of questions here. Jennifer, how do you manage distractions from the sidelines, like watching people who are watching you?
Good question. Okay, so yeah. A couple of things there. First of all, I used to play tennis in a bubble. So once I went on the court, there was this bubble around the court, and anything that happened was outside the bubble. So those things, they tried to get into my sphere, right? But I would kind of fight them off, right? I would just be like, that's out there and I'm in here and I'm going to try not to focus on that. Sometimes I use the boundaries of the court to, you know, get back into concentration. Cause when you go into changeovers, of course, in tennis, you have a changeover where your concentration stops. Generally should stop. You should relax in a changeover. You shouldn't be thinking about the match so much. Right. So once I crossed into the court. So once I crossed the alley line, then I was concentrating on the match again. Let's see what else. And then the last thing is I used to have this thing called the little black box. And the little black box was this box in my head that was made of steel and had a clamp. And whatever thoughts I had that I didn't want to have went in the box. So people trying to distract me from the outside or saying things or the fans or my coach saying the wrong thing or ball kids giving me the balls wrong or bad line calls or it could be things like life things, like my best friend's wife died during the French Open 1 year, my grandmother passed away, all these during the championships 1 year. So all these things would go in the box and I wouldn't let the contents of the box affect me, except for at the end of the match, when the match ended, then I would go back and examine what was in the box, like what was upsetting me. And then I would allow myself to have the emotion after the match. So I just put it in the box, clamp it shut and don't let it affect you.
Yeah, it's great. Great mental techniques. Awesome. John got to run, but love Gigi next time. Yes.
Hey, so John. Oh, John came to camp. John and Mary.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely check the replay out. Philip, thank you. You're welcome. Great stuff. Sherry, totally agree. Focus on your goals and you'll win every time. Winning isn't always victory in the match. That's true. True.
And the goal should never be to win. I always tell players, what's your goal to win? No, it can't be because winning happens on match point. What are you going to do between now and match point to achieve that, achieve your goals? What are your goals that are going to help you win the match? Not winning shouldn't be the goal.
Exactly. Hit deeper, you know, more first serve, stuff like that.
Right.
Awesome. Angel, what are some of the strategies you discuss with your teammate prior to any doubles match?
With your teammate. Okay. So first of all, it depends if it's a new person or somebody you've been playing with. You know, the first thing, if it's somebody you never played with, to physical and mental, right? The physical things are, what side do you like? Do you like the forehand, the backhand? What's your strength? What's your weakness? You're going to want to have those discussions. Generally, in doubles, you want the stronger ground strokes on the outside. Those stronger forehand plays the deuce, stronger backhand plays the at. And you want the stronger volleys in the middle. Or let's say weaker volleys on the outside. So if somebody has a really weak backhand volley, you put that in you put them on the outside, so the backhand volleys in the alley, because you're not going to hit a lot of backhand volleys there.
Gotcha.
And then from the mental side, you want to know what kind of person they are. Like, do they like to talk? Do they not like to talk? What kind of encouragement do they want? Some people don't want advice from you. Most people don't want advice from their partner. You know, it's like tennis is an individual sport. Like, it is a team in doubles, but there's really nothing you can do to help your partner play better. I always say that, but there's a lot you can do to make him play worse, right? But there's things you say. So all you can do really is be encouraging and be positive with them. And then also you need to have plans, right? What's your plan A, plan B? Like, they at minimum need to know, are you serving and volleying or serving and staying back? Do you like to return and come in? Or are you going to return and stay back? Mm-hmm. Communication between points is important in that sense, because you want to know what their plan is, you know, and find your strengths. Hopefully you have two plans, maybe three, plan A, plan B. Sometimes you need plan D. I didn't have to get to plan D often, but sometimes that we did. So you have to have all different plans there. I always tell players, like, every team, if you're playing somebody of your similar level, like, I mean, if you have 3-0 playing a 4-0, you're probably not going to win, right? I mean, it's not a fair match.
Yeah.
But most people have a solution. Most opponents have a solution because everybody has weaknesses, right? I mean, if at the pro level we can find weaknesses, then everybody has them. You just have to find them and exploit them. So it's doubles is a very strategic game, and I don't think people know enough about doubles to understand that part of it or spend enough time thinking about it, you know, about that part of the game. But it is highly strategic and tactical.
Yeah, very much so. That's what makes it fun. Let's see, Philip. Oh my goodness, I love Jose Ferrer. Absolutely magnificent in Cyrano and the cane. Nice, very cool. Jason, what are some poaches do's and don'ts?
Poaches do's and don'ts. Good question. Okay, so poaching is interesting because I don't know how old. Who is it?
Oh, Jason.
Jason, I don't know. Jason Bourne, is that his name?
Actually,
this is hysterical. I even read truly not Jason Bourne. Oh my god. Okay, so the timing of the poach. Okay, first of all, poaching is a physics problem. We have two moving objects and an interception point. The ball's moving, you're moving, and the interception point is somewhere over there. So depending on your velocity and the velocity of the ball and where the ball is, you know, with the trajectory of the ball, this could be unsolvable. Like the ball's moving too fast, you're too slow, and the poaching spot is too far away, right? Or it could be very poachable. The ball comes right to you, you hit it. But the reality is that, you know, or before I tell you the reality, when you start your poach, the optimal moment to start your poach is when your opponent has started their forward motion into the ball. Because at this point, it's very difficult to change your mind on your shot or even see that your opponent's poaching to change it. However, for a lot of people, that's too late because they're not quick enough or the ball's being hit too hard. So I like to do planned poaches in my early age. I started instituting planned poaches. When I plan before when I was playing, I went on instinct. You know, I was like, okay, I'm gonna go on this one, and I just knew which ball to go on. But it was really mostly a decision that I made before the point started. Like I would say, okay, my partner has a second serve, I'm just gonna take off. So I would just go. And sometimes they'd go behind me and that was fine. But most of the time it was the surprise element because the ball was moving so fast that I had to take off, right? And also planned poaches wouldn't have worked on tour because I would have to give it away. Like if I left too soon, then they'd go behind me, right? But recreational players are not as good as watching the other side of the court when they're hitting. Most people are not focused on the other side while they're striking the ball. It's a very difficult thing to do. Pros instructors can do this because they're playing and watching their students, right? But most people cannot do this. So when you plan the poach, you tell your partner, you give him a number behind your back. Okay, I'm going to go on the first ball, I'm going to go on the second ball, and then I'm going to go on the third ball. It should never be more than three because points in doubles, if you've heard Craig Kirk-O'Shaughnessy, like 95% of the points in doubles end within the first, 60% of the points end in the first four shots, like serve return, point after the serve, point after the return, point has ended. And then another large portion is eight shot rallies, right? So it's not going to go past that. So you're going to poach in the first, the second, and the third. That means when your opponent is hitting that number ball, you're going to take off, and you have to take off super early. Like I almost take off when the ball bounces. And again, you're going, your partner who's in the baseline is covering behind you. And what you're really trying to do is disrupt the person that's hitting the ball, disrupt your opponent. And you're trying to make them change your mind. Cause we know that in tennis, when you change your mind, you're more likely to miss the shot, miss your target than if you stick to your original shot. And there's all this data. Like, I don't know if you know this, Mervan, but back in the 80s, Jim Lehrer did a study on accuracy of players and accuracy specifically to when they change their mind. So what he did was, you know, he had a pro feed balls to, and this is Jim Courier, Andrew Agassi, all the guys at IMG Academy. I think David Wheaton was another one, and Martin Blackwell. Like, really, I think just Jang might have been a little bit young for this.
Okay.
So this is like high level players, right? So he would put targets on the other side of the court, a cross court target, a downline target, and the target would be like the target sign, like a bullseye, and then a ring around it, and another ring around it. So he would assign points, 10 points for hitting the middle, 5 points, 1 point, and then 0 points if you missed it. So he would feed him, you know, 10 forehands and say, okay, hit these cross court. And they would hit cross court and he would count. Okay, 10 for that, 5 for that, 3 for that. And he'd get the total number. Then he would say, okay, now when the ball is, you're going to do this cross court and do it down the line. You get the numbers for the down the line. Now when the ball's coming, I'm going to tell you whether to go cross court or down the line. So as the ball's coming, he would say cross court, down the line, cross court, down the line. So as you can imagine, the accuracy decreased because the player didn't know ahead of time which ball he was going to hit. But now what was interesting was he said, okay, now you're going to hit these cross court. But when the ball is coming, I'm going to tell you to hit it or down the line, whatever they were doing. When the ball's coming, I'm going to tell you to hit it down the line. So now I'm introducing doubt in your brain. But instead of listening to me, go back with your original thought, which was to hit a cross court. And then when he did that, the accuracy was almost exactly the same as when they didn't change their mind. So the lesson there was when a tennis player changes their mind, they should go with their first instinct because that's when you're going to be the most successful. Like, so don't second guess your shot selection. Go with the first instinct. And if the person has poached and you see that they poached, just try to hit the same shot, in the same direction, but maybe try to make it a little bit better or a little bit closer to the alley. But don't change your mind. So don'ts on poaching, you know, there's not very many don'ts on poaching. I mean, if you're going to get super technical, you don't want to turn your shoulders and like, I'll take any poaching to no poaching. Right. But if you want to be picky, don't turn your shoulders and go sideways and you want to move lateral or diagonal rather towards the center strap and not laterally across the court. Those are the two don'ts. But I prefer you moving laterally and turning your shoulders than not poaching at all. Because at least you're showing the opponent movement and you're trying to disrupt the opponent and not just being stationary in the middle of the box.
Yeah, exactly. Disturbing the rhythm. Awesome. That's a very cool story. Awesome. Thanks, Sherry. Probably benefited from feeling that the gods were with me and the pain was just unimportant. It's good. Good.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s inspired style and cutting edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Susanna, when losing is more common than winning, how do you learn to win? Talk to Jim Lehrer.
That's a good question. No, so I think when that happens, I'm thinking to drop the level of the competition. So it's very common with players, you know, like when you start playing on the equivalent of that on tour as a player going back to the challengers to play against lesser players. So if you're, you know, if you keep losing first round or main draw tournaments, go play a tier three event. Or a challenger where you're playing players that are ranked 300 instead of players that are ranked 50, and you'll start winning. So if you're playing 3-5 losing, go play 3-0. And I know you're going to say, nah, I don't want to do that because 3-0 is blah, 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 blah. But that's the solution. You have to play against weaker players or go play 2-5s. So then you win. And if you're 4-5, go play 3-5s, whatever it is, 4-0s, weak 4-0s. So you get used to winning because winning is a habit, you know, and then you're – also, your thoughts as you're winning, you develop your thoughts as you're winning too, which you don't develop those when you're losing. So that's what I say to that. Go play with worse players.
Awesome. Yeah, great advice. Definitely want to do that. Let's see some more questions. Can you review the Jim Lehrer advice between points then and now?
Then and now. Not sure what that means, but I can review the I call this the Crave sequence, and I don't remember exactly what he called it, and I think he had four steps, but you'll have the I did a little work when I created this product, the roadmap to mental dominance, and that's what I called it because it kind of makes sense of the things that you should do before the point starts or between points. right? The 25 seconds between points. And it's called CRAVE, for C-R-A-V-E, and it starts with chill, routine, analyze, visualize, execute. So the first thing when the point ends is you have to chill. Whether you won the point or lost the point, chill. It's just one point. It doesn't matter. Whether you won or lost, does not matter. The only point that matters is which point, match point, of course. You know, I tell players the stat that the percentage of points that the number one player in the world wins, Carlos Alcaraz right now, he wins 55% of all the points he plays. That means 45% of the time he's a loser, right? So we play in a sport where losing almost half the points in a match and you can still win, right? So it doesn't matter. One point doesn't matter. Chill, let it go. Won or lost. Don't get so excited about it and don't get upset if you lost it, unless it was match point. Then the match is over. So first you chill. Then you have to do your routines. As you do, your routines include, you know, what do you do with your strength? Are you looking at the racket? Where are your eyes? Are you stepping on the lines or not stepping on the lines? How do you pick up the ball specifically? Pick up the ball the same way every time. Then you're analyzing. As you're walking around doing your routines, you're analyzing what happened on the last point. How did I win it? How did I lose it? And then you also want to think about what you're going to do on the next point. Am I going to serve and volley, serve and stay back, return and come in, et cetera. Then you have to have, before the point starts, quick visualization. And the visualization could be you watching yourself hit the serve into a target, or it could be just a positive self-talk or something, any kind of visualization you want to make, any kind of self-talk that's positive. And then, of course, you have to execute. And to execute, you have to have trigger words. And trigger words are words in your head that elicit some behavior in your body. Like, for example, for me, I knew that under pressure, my left arm on my serve was going to come down. Ever so slightly. And so I would hit the top of the tape and miss my serve. So my cue word on my serve was left arm up. So I was like, as I was doing my routines and doing my balancing and all that, my last thought was always left arm up. Now that had a triple benefit. The first one was I'm keeping my left arm up because I'm telling myself to keep my left arm up. Because I'm telling myself to keep my left arm up, I can't have a thought I don't want to have. Like I can't be thinking, oh God, don't double fault, or oh God, it's match point, because I'm thinking left arm up. And then the third one, and probably the most important one, is because I'm thinking left arm up on the first point, the second point, the third point, the 10th point, and the match point. Then the match point seems like just another point. It doesn't seem like any more important than all the other points. So yeah, those trigger words, your trigger words usually are derived from something that happens, whatever you're working on in your game, it's going to go off under pressure. So whether you're trying to reach more on your serve or turn your shoulders more or use your legs more or snap the wrist or accelerate, whatever it is you're trying to do, that's what your trigger word should be, because under pressure, it won't be there for you. So that's a long version of the CRAVE sequence, or the short version.
Dude,
practice
awesome,
it, you know, practice. And you know, when you start doing rituals or routine between points, you have to think about it a lot. But after a while, it becomes a habit, and you're not so much focusing on what you're doing; you're just doing it without having to think about it.
Awesome, love it. Thanks, Gigi. Family fun night. If I'm losing in doubles, I'll often ask my partner if they have any suggestions on strategies, but they look at me with a blank stare. Are there prompts? Are there any prompts you would suggest for this conversation, Jenna?
Well, it's hard to answer because it depends on where you're losing. You know, are you losing because of bad strategy? Or are you losing because you're missing? Are you losing because are you defeating yourself, or are the opponents better? Are you playing the weaker player? I guess the first question is, should we hit more to another player? Maybe should we isolate that other player? Should we, if you've been staying back, should we try to serve volley? Should we try to come in more to the net? And again, always reference this advice in plural. So we should be doing this, or how about we try to do this, or we try to do that. But yeah, that's a tough one, because I don't know if I'd answer the question, but that's what I got.
Yeah, no, that was good. Let's see. Nancy, good to see you, Gigi. Any thoughts on how coaches take players out of the zone? So is that I guess that's a problem that you're asking about?
Yeah. Maybe. How coaches take players out of the zone. Yeah. Stay out of their way. Yeah. So yeah, sometimes coaches, I mean, I don't think on tour, because I think if they do that, they're going to get fired. Right. But so I believe with coaching, like really less is best. Like you don't want to overcoach in a match situation. And they also keep the coaching to, I would say, more like just basic advice, nothing technical, maybe some tactic change or maybe some mental help, but you need to put more topspin on your forehand. Like, terrible. Like, I don't want to know that. Don't tell me that. Now I'm going to worry about my forehand instead of worrying about winning the point, which is what I should be worrying about.
Yeah, no, very true. Let's see any other questions. I mean, there are some. Oh, Robbie. Hey, Gigi. Hi, I'm your bomb girl. The awesome Robbie. We're all here watching at Hershey Racquet Club. Love Gigi. Loving Tennis Summit. Love to hear that.
Oh, that's great.
A yoga master. Yeah, yes. She's great.
We have a little secret that we might have to share with people soon.
Oh, yes. Feel free to share.
Did you hear about this?
Oh, is it? It's not this the double summit or?
Oh, no, we can talk about that later. Oh. No, I think Robbie and I are going on Below Deck and some other friends. We're going Below Deck again. Yeah.
Whoa.
Below Deck Greece. I'm not supposed to say anything, but we're going on Below Deck Greece, probably.
Whoa. That's insane. Fun
in August.
Whoa. Yeah. Wow.
If anybody wants to go, we have one spot left. Anybody want to go, or maybe two, I forget, one or two. Yeah, if you have $20,000 and you want to go to Below Deck Greece, email me.
Oh boy, maybe after the summit. Let's see. That's really cool. Super cool. Let's see. Oh shoot, actually, I should have asked you this before, Gigi. Do you have to go pretty soon? I know it's 1:00.
No, I'm good.
Okay.
I have a two.
Okay. Awesome. I appreciate it. Okay, thanks so much. Philip, I have trouble with my doubles players staying a positive with each other and not saying this like, we'll just move along and we'll stop losing. Yeah. I mean, it's a common question, but use what the techniques Gigi mentioned earlier and you'll be okay. Let's see. Macy, thank you for doing these Q&As so helpful. Philip, yes, thank you. We, not you. There you go. You're getting it. We framing, you know, the advice and whatnot. Gigi, that's a great strategy. I think, again, referencing that. Philip, I think we mentioned this already, the focus on 25 seconds. So definitely rewind. Although I know you asked that a little while ago, so you might have heard it already. The answer. Any chance you're going to do a SoCal clinic from Steve?
Oh, I've done so many clinics in Southern Cal. I don't know, probably 8 or 10 of them. So, and Indian Wells is a good option, Steve. I do camps in Indian Wells every year. They're very popular. If you want to get into those camps, go to gfernandestennis.com and find the camps page, Indian Wells, and fill in a form that's their interest form. There's a long list of people that have been trying to get on, and I'm kind of getting through it. So I do 3 or 4 camps every year. I have a goal to hit all 50 states. With my G Method clinics, I'm doing Mississippi and Alabama this month, actually in a couple of weeks, and Nashville in June. And after that, I'll have 37 down and 13 to go. So that's been a fun challenge and fun goal that I'm going to someday finish achieving. So,
wow, dang, that's super
SoCal,
cool.
SoCal, Indian Wells next March.
Sweet. Awesome. Love Indian Wells. Sparks, Sky, how do partners decide who should play the ad side or the do side?
Yeah, talking about that a little bit. First of all, the best player should play the ad side. No, unless you're playing no ad, the best player should play the ad side. If you're even out, I talked about having the strong ground strokes on the outside and the weak volleys also on the outside. So weak back and volleys. So the back and volleys in the alley and you want your strong ground strokes on the outside.
Gotcha. So I guess just to, you know, give you a scenario again, like, so if you have one player who has like a much stronger forehand than his backhand, whereas the other person, he or she, like is, you know, equally strong forehand and backhand. However, I mean, let's just say for this example, the male player is stronger. So, and the male player like likes the deuce side, whatever. But like if the male player is stronger, but has a weaker backhand, would you still put the male on the ad side? Or,
well, depends on how close they are. Like if the guys and can the if you're playing mixed doubles, can the woman return the guy's serve? That's the determining factor, because you have a woman who cannot return the other guy's serve and you put her in the outside, you're going to lose the match. Mm. No question. You're going to lose the match, because if you can't break and you can't win your points on that side on the tie break, if there's no breaks, how are you going to win? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you might get lucky and win, but if the girl cannot return the guy's serve, then she needs to play the deuce side.
Gotcha.
Otherwise you're relying on the guy double faulting on game point to win a game. You know.
Yeah, that's a great point. Let's see, Jay. It looks like stroke techniques, especially for, I'm not sure what that was referring to. It's a while back, but hey, from Taiwan. So cool to see everyone from different places.
Wow, hey,
Woody, what's up? Oh, okay. Jason, it seems the forehand technique has changed from the time in the 90s and now. Do you agree? And do you suggest your students to mimic pros strokes?
Wait, what? Can you repeat that?
Sorry. Yeah, it says, so it seems that the forehand technique has changed from the 90s to now. So first question is, do you agree? And then second is, do you suggest your students to mimic the pros strokes?
Yes. Yes, I agree. And yes, I agree with all of it, because back in the day when I was playing, we didn't have the string technology that is available today, or the racket technology even. So the strokes are a little more linear, or a little bit flatter than they are today, because we couldn't generate the spin that they're generating today we didn't have the string technology. So if it's for a high level player, then you definitely want to, you know, sort of follow modern technology, or modern teaching tactics, but also the movement, you know, like the whole open stance in my generation. I didn't learn open stance when I was playing or when I was growing up. I learned it on tour, but open stance is now the way to hit every stroke, because it saves 1, 2, or 3 steps on the recovery, right? So both moving so fast, you really have no choice but to hit open stand.
Yeah, it's definitely evolved for a reason. Makes sense for us to mimic, you know, if we're physically capable. Chris, how do you find the balance between hitting through the ball and brushing up on any given shot?
Good question. Well, brushing, you know, like I don't think of brushing up. I don't like that. I mean, you kind of have to brush up, but the brushing up is happening as a result of the swing path of the racket, right? The racket's coming from high to low, and as you're moving through, then you're going to generate spin, but I'm not thinking of brushing up. Like if you're trying to mimic Rafa's boogie whip or whatever they call his brand, like don't, like that's just not a normal thing that most human beings can do. But really, of the two, if you're following through on the shot and you're coming from low to high, you should get the spin that you need without having to think of brushing through.
Gotcha. Thanks, Gigi. Let's see some comments. Joy, such great psychological, mental, and practical info. Thank you, Gigi. Definitely agree, Joy. Jamie. Hello, Jamie. I've played 2 singles matches recently where I started very strong, but eventually I couldn't maintain that level and lost. It seemed more mental than physical. And any mental game advice for mid-match?
That's a very common error. And people, it's not that it's an error. It's that also there's all this mental, I guess, a game at play. You know, what happens when you're up a set and say a break, so you're up on the first set and you're winning the second, is that now your opponent relaxes, because see, you get to the point where it's like, okay, I'm gonna lose, so then the pressure goes off them, and oftentimes they raise their level. So the key is to as the match starts and continues, that you always want to be thinking of increasing your own intensity. So you want to always increase your intensity in a match, whether you won the set, lost the set. It always needs to be in an upward spiral, because as soon as it levels, like if you think I'm in a good level, I'm going to stay here. But what's happening is like, they're going to start getting better. Right. So now unless you start getting better with them and matching their intensity, then they're going to start playing better than you. So the key is to, it's not to play better as the match progresses, but to raise the intensity, to raise your focus, to raise your concentration levels, and to continue that in an upward spiral as the match progresses. Then it's impossible to have a letdown, because you're trying to always increase.
That's right. Intensity. So huge. Hey, Emma. Hey, guys. So happy I got on here live with you. appreciate it and looking forward to our live on Saturday as well. That'll be really fun. Let's see. David, I would like to know when you are about to hit a shot. When is the last time you look at your opponent to see where they are moving?
Well, I wish people would tell me their rating when they ask these questions, because this is a bit rave dependent. Like, I'm a bad example of this, because obviously I'm highly skilled.
Right? Yes.
like when people were, like, if somebody was doing eye formation on me, I could wait for them to go one way or the other before I'd made my decision.
Wow.
But that wasn't always successful, right? But I could a lot of the times wait for them to go one way or the other. So as that ball is being served, I have my eye on the ball, but I also have this peripheral vision, or the ability to see almost two things at once. So I could see what the server did after they served it. Did they take a step to the right or to the left? And then did the net person move and go one way or the other? And then I would hit my shot in the other direction. So I could kind of hold it, and then last minute just kind of flick it one way or the other. But that's really hard to do. So so to answer your question, when is the last time you look at your opponent? Really, you should be watching the ball. And depending on how hard the ball is coming, so if it's a floater, you know, it's like you have a little more time and you can kind of peek over there. Peek. But I'm a little concerned with this question, because I don't know his rating, and I don't know, you know, when taking your eye off the ball is generally, for most recreational players, a recipe for disaster.
It's tough to say. Yeah, because I think probably people would think, like, you know, you watch the ball until the opponent hits it and then you start tracking the ball. But I guess there's, like, yeah, you know, like you said, it depends, like, what level and, like, what type of shot.
How
even
hard. Yeah,
all these things.
You know, if you're sitting on a bounced overhead and you're, like, looking at the balls bouncing, you're waiting to hit it, you can kind of see where they're going, and then you hit it. That's the thing, right? If you have a sitter forehand, you know, the ball's sitting there and you're gonna decide if you're gonna go across or down the line, you can kind of watch them and see if they're running one way or the other, and you hit it the other way. But I'll tell you a really interesting sad story in my life about changing my mind on a shot. And it was in the 1994 Wimbledon semifinal. I was playing Martina Navratilova, who was 38 at the time. I started out really nervous. Like, first day, I lost the first four games, first Wimbledon semi ever. Then I started coming back, lost the first at 6-4, and I'm 5-2 in the second set, serving for the set at 5-3. And she was tired. She was tapped. I mean, she was 38 and she'd had a long week playing doubles too. And I think, you know, if I win this set, I'm in the third set. I have a really good chance of making the Wimbledon final. And I serve volley, hit it out wide. And I'm coming in. I have a fairly makeable, high level, sort of shoulder level forehand volley. And I have an open court, cross court volley. She's a lefty, so she would be running down to chase a backhand.
Yeah.
And as I'm hitting that shot, just about as I was starting to hit the shot, I see her take off to cover it. And I just changed my mind and went down the line. And the ball hit the tape, went up in the air, hit the tape again, went up in the air, hit the tape again, seemed like slow motion, and landed on my side of the court.
No.
And that was to win the second set. If I have one shot I regret in my life, it's that shot. Because if I hit that shot cross court, I probably would be a Wimbledon champion, because I would have played Conchita Martinez in the finals and I had good chances against her. So, my one shot regret out of a whole career, I have one shot regret that I can remember. I
appreciate you bringing that up, even though it's painful. I would just try to forget about that. But, you know, it happens.
No, obviously, you know, I didn't remember. I actually didn't remember this until actually Pete Freeman sent me this video of the Wimbledon final. And I knew that I had the set point. I really knew I had the set point. But when I saw it, I'm like, oh, why did I change my mind? And then it all came back. It's like, oh God, I remember this point now. You know, it's like, keep it. Go with your first instinct. Never change your mind.
Lesson there again. Yeah, smart. Yeah. It's all good. Let's see what other questions. I mean, we have a lot of thank yous, which is awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. No problem, Woody. Hey, Gigi, remember Ryan. Thanks for doing this. And
all right.
Ryan's awesome. Obviously, he was at TennisCon Live. And we had a live stream earlier today, and Ryan was talking about how he changed what he taught in terms of when the serve goes to the inside stroke, where like that ball is tends to go more down the line. Like he actually used to teach differently, I think, where he thought that you should. I forgot what he said, but
no, I know
has he
exactly
talked to you about that?
Oh my God, I am so happy that I'm hearing this, Ryan. You have no idea how excited I am. So we're talking about inside shots and doubles. And inside shot is a shot that you hit from the inside of the court. So if you're on the outside and you have a forehand cross court goes into the alley, the alley in front of you, right? So a lot of coaches coach that's a poachable ball, but it is on tour because this ball is hit so hard that players are late and you can try to poach that. But if you don't have a huge serve, someone can, you know, hit that step in and hit a cross court into the alley and you're toast. So that's sort of one of the sort of differentiators of one of several things that I teach differently than most people. So I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. Thanks for
and the other thing that I'm working hard to convince coaches is stop telling recreational players to follow the ball, because you really should not be following the ball. You should just stay in the middle of the box and let the opponent try to hit a backhand down the line into their alley, into your alley. It is the lowest percentage shot in tennis. They're going to make it 1 out of 10 times. If they're 4 or 5 or above, they're going to make it 1 out of 10 times. If they're 4 or below, maybe once in a while, you're going to make this shot from the baseline. If you're standing in the baseline, now, if you're standing on the service line, different story, then you got to watch it. But you know, the problem with recreational players is like, or you know, 3, 5, 4 players, like when they start to follow the ball, they don't know where to stop. So the ball goes that way, they keep going that way. And now we have the situation where one person's covering the alley and the other person's scoring 90% of the court. So I'm still working on it. I'm still working on sharing with more my instruction with more people, so people really understand the game of doubles better. And that's my mission in life. More people teaching good doubles.
Good stuff. Yeah. It's a great mission. Very sorely needed. Angel, miss you this AM. Yeah, to Ryan. Yeah, just watch the replay for sure. Maggie, hola from Acapulco, Gigi Mirabon. This is a great question, because we had some discussions about this with both Brent and Ian, and they had like sort of different opinions, although they could probably come to a middle ground. But when do you look at your partner while playing the point at the net?
My partner?
Yeah. So I guess like you're at the net, you know, like, so the questions we had was like primarily like when there was a serve to your partner, like, are you looking back at them? You know what I mean? Or like, when do you look
back?
They didn't
agree what I'm going to pick on them now. What were they saying?
So Brent said that he likes to look at his partner, like when the partner's returning, so that he knows like what type of shot is going to like come about from the return. And like, he cited Brian Brothers and whatnot. Ian was more in the camp of that you don't look back and you look at the players in front of you. And then I guess there was some talk about
who's depends. Brent? Do I know Brent?
Well, Brent Abel from Web Tennis. He's pretty good player. He's like got like 14.
He's also 85 years old, right? Isn't he like super old?
I don't know how old Brent. He is. He looks young though. I mean, for his age, whatever it is, but
sorry, Brent. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to pick on Brent. I 100% disagree with turning around and looking at your partner, because if you watch the opposing net player, okay, the ball, so you're returning, right? Your partner's returning, rather. The ball has crossed the net, right? Mm-hmm. And if you watch the opposing net player, that's all you need to know. Because if they move, then you know that you have to be ready. You know that your partner's hit a bad shot, right? But if they don't move, you don't need to watch your partner. The problem with watching your partner is that you can't see your opponent, and you have to see your opponent. You have to see if your opponent is going to poach or not poach so you can be ready. That's why when you ask that question, I'm like, when do I look at my partner? I've never in my life looked at my partner. I mean, I might glance, right?
Yeah.
But
is that
but
what
also,
Brian Brothers do? Brian Brothers?
They don't, there's no way the Brian Brothers are turning and watching. I can promise you that. And in fact, next time they come to my camp, which we do every February, we can ask them. Because the other thing is, how in tune are you with your partner? Like, I knew when the ball was coming what kind of shot Natasha was going to hit without having to look at her. Like, I knew if it was a really wide serve and she was going to be stretched, I already knew I needed to move to the center because she might hit it down the line and I'd have to cover the middle. right? I knew if it was coming to her body, she was going to hit it inside out. I knew if it was, she was stretched on the backhand, she was probably going to lock. Like I knew. And also I could tell, the other thing I could tell is when the ball, when she hit her return and the ball was passing me over here, right, to my right, because I was on the outside. When the ball was passing me, I could tell if I was a good shot or not a bad shot. And I can start to see that when the ball is even with me. And I'm standing in the service line and I see this ball. Okay, where is this ball? Is it low or is it high? If it's high, I'm like, shit, I got to back up. If it's low, I'm going forward, right? Yeah. So at no point in that did I turn and watch her.
Gotcha.
For the most part. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but for the most part, I was definitely watching the court. Gotcha. Sorry, Brent, but that's okay. You know, for him, it could work. And for some people, it could work. But for me, it didn't work.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's great to get that perspective, obviously. Let's see. Okay. Kate. Hey, Kate. Hi, Gigi. What if your partner keeps hitting out missing and they are now targeting her? How do you help her?
Yeah, that's tough because, you know, and so one thing you could do if you're one up, one back and your partner's missing, like go back to the baseline with her and maybe try to take the middle balls. And then when the ball comes to you, then have her run to the net. Right. So now you're in the back and she's up. So if they hit the ball to her, now she's at the net, which, you know, presumably she was missing ground strokes. Right. So that's why I'd say to that, like if somebody's missing from the ground strokes, then bring her back. If they're missing volleys, I'm sorry, if they're missing ground strokes, bring her up. If they're missing volleys, bring him back. So try to take him away from the shot they've been missing.
Gotcha. Thanks, Gigi. Raquel, Rich, when are you coming to Oregon? We need you.
I haven't been to Oregon. That's one of my spots. No, wait, I've been to Oregon. I was in Portland. Yeah, I already did Oregon. That one's marked off, but I'm coming to Idaho, which I haven't done that one. So that's close to Oregon as I'm going to get in the near future. And I think I'm coming hopefully to Montana in October.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Awesome. Hello to Jim. Jim has a question. Can you address doubles tactics based upon age, ability, and opponents? Ooh. Coaches and drills.
We need another hour session for that one.
That will be the topic of our next live stream.
The next entire tennis summit will be about that question.
Yes, exactly. And check out Gigi's double
summit. Or buy the Gigi method or come to my camps or come to the double summit. That's a loaded question, Jim.
Let's see the second part. Coaches and drills give the same advice to all 12, whether you're 69 with bad knees or a 30-year speedster. Bad advice. No. So yeah, certainly it's different. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely different. Yeah, 100%. You know, one of the things that's different I feel about the G method is that it's really modified for recreational players. Like, you know, what I call the G method, which is how I think doubles should be played. It's not how I played on tour, not entirely, because I could do things that, you know, the way I covered the court was a little bit different than, you know, now I cover the court at 60, right? So you have to definitely coach to the ability or agility, but more than the ability, the agility of the player.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I got a little distracted because did you hear the news? So when you mentioned Boise State, the men's team at Boise State, like they're going to be penalized or have been because the assistant coach was paying like other players like $2,000 per recruit or something like that. It's crazy.
I thought that was allowed now.
I don't know. It says, according to this article, it says that they were. Yeah, it's a violation, so I don't know. Anyway, sorry, it's so random. Let's see. Thanks, guys. Ni hao, Taiwan. Cool. Let's see. Angel, thank you so much, Gigi and Maribon. Oh, okay. Jerry, I do not hear this question or did not hear it. If you lose your toss mid-game, what should you do? Is there a good strategy in this case besides focus, i.e. have two serve movements?
Oh, wow. If you lose your toss mid-game. So toss routines are important, like where are you tossing the ball? What are you thinking about in your toss? Like I used to follow the path of the post, or some people like the Bryan brothers teach follow the path of the baseline. So you need to have some type of guide to help you. And I think that if you do that, you shouldn't lose it, because if you're always following the path of the post and always throwing up the ball the same way and the same way and the same way, then if you lost your toss, then it would be a mental issue, not a physical issue. So, find a guide, find a path to your arm that will help you get it started.
Got awesome. Thanks, GG. Let's see. Jim's 3-5, just a reference. Okay, cool, cool. Let's see. Ash, in doubles, a lefty-righty combo, lefty is stronger than righty. In no ad high-performance junior match, who should take the deuce and ad side? Thank you.
Easy. If it's no ad, you won the forehand volleys in the middle. So that Brian Brothers model, right? I mean, the Brian Brothers changed the way righty-lefty combinations play doubles. Before the Brian Brothers, all righty-lefty combinations had the lefty on the outside. Martina, Mark Woodford and Todd Woodbridge, Martina and Pam, McEnroe and whoever he was playing, Rod Laver, what other lefties, always on the left side, on the ad side, lefties on the ad side. The Brian Bros were the first team to switch that. And why? Because of technology. So again, before the advent of, you know, carbon rackets and poly strings, if I served, still in my generation, it was like that. If I had a lefty playing the deuce side, I would serve wide to their backhand every single serve. And it was nearly impossible to hit that return cross court. It would be nearly impossible for them to hit that return cross court past the net player. So my partner would just poach on every ball, and the only thing they could do was lob the return. With the advent of this new technology now, you know, anybody could be late on a backhand and just like flick it cross court. So people were start getting really good about flicking backhands cross court, taking it early on the rise, and just using the technology in the racket to hit the ball early and hit it cross court. So if the lefty can return a wide backhand with any kind of success, then they should be there. So we have the forehand volleys in the middle. If they cannot, then you got to reverse it. But now you got the backhand volleys in the middle, which is not great. Rick gotcha. Leach was another example of a great doubles player who mostly played the outside. Outside. Or did he play the deuce side? I think he played the outside. I don't remember.
I can't remember either. I think he's in our area. Mid-Atlantic. But okay, let's see. David, I'm a 4-0. Of course you want to watch ball. Yep. But I'm guessing I'm asking to see where I can eventually. Which one was that?
That was about watching the opponent. So he's a 4-0.
Oh, yeah.
So that, I mean, it's hard to answer that. It's hard. I can't give you a precise moment because really I was talking about the peripheral vision. Like there's two visions. There's the focus on the ball with this understanding of what's happening peripherally. So to me, that's more like a peripheral vision answer. Like you're watching the ball, but you're aware of your surroundings, or you're aware of what the other person's doing without actually having to look over there at them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Let me see who else hasn't asked a question. Well, I just put Ryan up real quick. Learned a lot from Gigi, and I was so glad to hear her instructions and change what I taught based on her teachings. Thanks, Gigi. You got to love it. You know, there's a lot of coaches who are, you know, stuck to the ways and whatnot, but you just learn and refine.
Thank you, Ryan. So. I appreciate that.
Yeah, Ryan. Awesome. Chris, do you adjust your swing path on every shot, or is it pretty consistent regardless of ball, pace, height, et cetera?
No, I don't. I mean, what you want to do is adjust your body for the most part, right? You have to move your body. So you have your ideal strike zone. For most people, it's somewhere around your waist. Your waist level, maybe a little bit above, depending on your grip. But, and then, so you move your body so that when you get to the ball, you're in that ideal zone. So like what pros are really good at becoming little robots. So everything's the same. What changes is where the ball is. And then, so then you'll have your high balls that you're going to take early, and you try to avoid low balls, really try to avoid hitting balls at your shoe tops or below the knees. So move your body to get to the right spot.
Yeah.
Thanks. Just a couple more minutes before I have to take off.
Yeah, no. A couple more questions. Totally. Thanks for the advice. No problem. What can I say as a coach to a high school player who is going to play against a superior player?
Well, you got nothing to lose, right? Yeah. I mean, I always say there's three types of situations that you face. You're better than your opponent, you're worse than your opponent, you're even with your opponent. Depending on these three, you adjust your risk level. If you're better than your opponent, you take no chances. You're going to win, you're better. Even if they get on a hot streak, you just keep telling yourself, I'm better, I'm going to win. If you're worse than your opponent, then you got to take all kinds of chances because otherwise you're going to lose. Just go for it. Go for your shots. You have nothing to lose. And then if you're even with your opponent, then you have to modify when you take risk and when you don't take risk. And when you don't take risk on the big points, because tennis is a game of errors, 60 to 70% of all the points in doubles end in an error. So you don't want to be making an error by trying a low percentage shot on a big point. The big points are, of course, game point. The fourth point of the game, 30-15, I'm sorry, the third point of the game, 30, wait, is that? Fourth point of the game, 30-15, 15-30, 40-love, love 40-point. That's a big point. It's a swing point in a game. And also the first point of the game. Because if you win the first point of the game, you're like 78% more likely to win that game than if you lose it. And also because the changeovers in recreational tennis or even pro tennis are, and recreational tennis are tend to be social, but in pro tennis too, like there's a break in the action. So you have, your mind has been at ease for a minute or 30 seconds, however long your changeover is. So you have to get back in it. So I always want to play that point with intensity, like it's a big point and not make a silly mistake.
Yeah. Awesome, G. I know we've hit 1:30, so I'll let you go, but I really appreciate your time and everybody's questions. This was super fun. And as we predicted, like, you know, we still have questions, but we got to end.
Let me just say, Can I say two things?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I just have two things coming up. So I'm doing less teaching and more experiential travel. I will have the double summit in November. And this is like sort of the one camp where people can come and learn the G method from me. It's in Tampa, and this one has on court, off court. So I have Mark Kovacs and a couple of sports psychologists. We try to approach the complete player and what you need to be doing so that you're not just good at tennis, but you have to be good off the court and et cetera, et cetera. That, and then the other thing that I'm talking about is the Laver Cup. Like, if anybody wants to go to the Laver Cup, I'm a G Finesse Tennis's official North America travel partner. So hopefully if you are going, you want to come with me. Super fun. Like London, everybody got pictures with every player except for Roger. Roger was impossible to get to, but everybody got pictures with just about every player that played at the Laver Cup. So if that Laver Cup's in your plans, or you want to do a doubles camp in the fall, bring your friends. This camp is here in Tampa and it's super fun. So hopefully I'll get to meet some of you guys in person. And of course, we'll have the Tennis Con Live if you want to work with Mirban next year again. We'll do that. And that's in, it'll probably be again in that March timeframe.
Yeah, definitely. I have family in Vancouver, so I'm going to try to get to the Laver Cup. So hopefully I can see you there at some,
great.
Some point. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, let's talk. If you're coming, let's call me afterwards. We'll talk about that.
Sure. Awesome. Again, thanks so much, Gigi, and everybody. This was so much fun. And yeah, we'll see you at the next live stream tomorrow. But hope you have a great day and enjoy the rest of the summit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. I hope you really enjoyed this discussion, this Q&A session with Gigi Fernandez. A really fun one. I always love doing those. Because you get questions on the fly, the guests, just, you know, answers through all of the experience that they've had. So really fun. And if you enjoyed this one, I would appreciate it if you would leave a review for the Tennis Files podcast. And you can do that at tennisfiles.com/Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app that you use to listen to the show. I also want to leave you with a quote. And this one is by Lena Dunham. And Lena said, "It is interesting how often we can't see all the ways in which we are being strong." It's a really deep quote there. I hope that I didn't mispronounce Lena's name too badly. But in any case, yeah, I hope you all just continue to strive to figure out what it is that's maybe keeping you from reaching the next level, and then just putting a game plan together and improving that. So that's the best feeling when you do finally get a solution going your issues. So with that, I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the podcast. Have a great one and see you then.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.